Mère Fantôme. Grammaire Fantôme. Une émission par Nadia Lichtig.
Hello, Ingrid Koenig. Hello, Randy Lee Cutler. We meet today via Zoom. You're in Vancouver and I'm here in the south of France. And before I left Vancouver, it gave me a book called Leaning Out of Windows, an Art and Physics Collaboration. I would love to hear a bit more about that. And the first question would be, what was the initial trigger for this collaboration?
Question. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It goes back a ways. I would say it goes back 20 years. And more than that, because Randy has an art and science background within her own research and in art history, and I was working with the subjects of climate change in the 90s, and which eventually brought me into more of the scientific realm as well. And I started to work with physics communications as a way, as you know, looking at how aspects of chaos theory would be communicated through scientific visuals besides math. And so in my own artistic practice, I started to work with this bringing together human experience and physics ideas and the imagery within that, but so combining vocabulary within science communication with our everyday life, so images from everyday life, such as bowls, for example.
I was just thinking, Ingrid, that you know, one of the lovely stories that you tell is that a lot of this came out of raising your kids and them asking you questions, and they would, you know, that, you know, why, and then you would have to go and do your research, and then out of that, it was always about communication. It was always about science, and it was always about visuality, right? And then it's got all these layers on top of it, as you say, in the last 25 years and more.
Yeah. In that sense, when a child asks you, where did everything come from? And, you know, how do I fit into that? And if I'm a good person, will I have a good life? And, you know, all those kinds of questions. And so bringing that scientific text into that to answer them in the where we are within our own knowledge about the universe today is the thing that as I was looking for the answers for them and explaining that to them, it also refired up my own passion around those ideas. And yeah, so those are all the triggers that started that working, creating that body of work. And at a certain point, Randy was saying to me, it was because we were teaching colleagues, or still are, and early on in our friendship, and she said, why don't you teach the research that you're doing in a humanities class? And I thought, yeah, that's a great, I'd love to do that. And one of the things in preparing for that class, because I'm not a physicist, I thought, well, I knew about this lab, accelerator lab out at UBC, the Triumph Particle Accelerator Center. And I thought, well, I'll go and visit them and see what I could do for my students, and also, you know, an interface with the physicists there. So I went, introduced myself. They gave me a tour, and I proposed to them this class that I'm teaching. Would it be possible for me to bring my students there and also have the physicists come to my class to explain some of the, you know, mysteries of the universe, like, you know, dark matter, black holes. And of course, you know, once they started to come to my class, the the kinds of questions that came out. It's always, often it's that question of what is the edge of the universe, or those kinds of very difficult things to take hold of. So in essence, in starting to teach that course and having that interaction and triumph, the people there, the community was so welcoming. And so I started to build a trust with them as well, and sort of collaborating with those physicists and how they came into my class, and so that back and forth with my own students, experiencing the messiness of a lab, which was always so surprising to everyone, to myself as well, and how this lab that researches, the fundamental particles and behavior of atomic matter and kind of solar and cosmic forces, how they are exploring that with the physicality of a lab, with magnets, with that the pipes
Tinfoil.
being a very crude in describing that, but there is that kind of crudity of the material reality of what you're working with in a lab. So anyway, that was part of that, and eventually all that led to working on a larger scale of it, bringing artists and physicists together with these interactions.
I want to jump in for a sec. Just to say that my own background, I did a PhD at the Royal College of Art in London, UK, and it was on art and science, specifically surrealism, and looking at how the surrealists were engaging with science from their own middle-class backgrounds, but also how they were trying to. I was thinking a lot about unreason. So the reason why I share that is because Ingrid and I both come from these interests, and then when we met each other and found each other, we saw that there were these overlaps. So our interest in art and physics collaboration is about collaboration, right? So, like the collaboration of what we see between art and science, respectively, as artists and researchers, and also working together. I mean, Ingrid and I have this collaboration, which starts to open things up. And then, as Ingrid's just recounted, meeting with Triumph, and then we developed the collaboration there. And then we also brought in our undergraduate students and our grad students. So I think what's really exciting about this is all the different layers and concentric circles of engagement that really surprised us. But I think for me personally, really opened up the experience where we were learning from so many different people. And that was, I think, such a pro at over a period of 6 years in the case of leaning out of windows.
Before going over to the next question, I want to react on two things you just said. So, Ingrid, you spoke about the messiness of the lab, which is surprising to me to hear. Do you see a parallel to the studio of the artist? And secondly, then I would like to ask Randy about surrealism and science.
That kind of messiness that entails a range of materials, wires, tape, tinfoil. I mean, it's a kind of a quirky kind of thing. In the corners of the lab, there'd be a shopping cart full of different, I don't know how to even describe it, just different kinds of materials that are used in the making of bringing that equipment together. And yet there's also a really high tech production facility for making the perfect fitting pipes and connections for the accelerator itself. So there's that range of sophistication of materiality, but the materiality itself is the reality here as well, and how that material can then be engaged with electromagnetic forces and magnetism to look at collisions and to recreate what happens within the cosmos itself with the massive kinds of effects and behaviors that occur. So one of the physicists that we've worked with, David Morrissey, he said one time, he can see the overlap between what physicists and artists do, in the sense that we follow the process leads us. We follow, we don't know where we're going, and the process of the making of the doing is the thing that we follow and brings us to a place. And I think that's very much, true in terms of art practice itself.
Should I go into a surrealism? So surrealism is always part of my sensibility, even, however conflicted I feel about it now in hindsight for all kinds of reasons. But back when I was doing the PhD at the Royal College of Art, I ended up writing a paper called The Songs of Science. And it was about the kind of origins of surrealism, sort of starting in 1919, and I think I ended in 1936. And I was interested in this idea of unreason. So, sort of taking scientific methods, scientific imagery, and then how the surrealists deployed them toward aesthetic experimentation. So, the earliest example, which is, more Dada than surrealism, is automatic writing. So, it's a therapeutic method that Freud developed, but then the surrealists use it to create poetry. But you also see this with so many of the surrealists. Many of them studied science, they were all kind of professionals in some way. And then the First World War happened, and that really undermined their faith in science. And they started to sort of see it in new ways. It was really interested in that. And I guess what I'll also add is that the degree I did was in cultural history. So my training was in art history, but the degree at the Royal College was in cultural history. And that helped me to recognize my interest in the cultural context that produces art and science. So that these things obviously don't exist in a vacuum, and they're informed by the ideas of the day, they're informed by the people that you collaborate with. So I became more interested not so much in the objects of surrealism, but in the cultural context of surrealism. And then realizing how so many of them were engaged with, different disciplines from mathematics to anthropology to archaeology. So that re was really interesting for me. And I think one of the things that I ex re recognized was how surrealism was about the more than real, what's under the surface, what's in the unconscious, the uncanny. And as we worked with the physicists at Triumph, one of the things that I really enjoyed was their own interest in aesthetics, their own interest in the unknown, their own interest in, especially the theoretical physicists, trying to make sense out of very complex problems, and also their own interest in creativity. So in some ways, I feel like that work that I did informed my relationship with Ingrid and informed my relationship with Triumph and continues to inform looking for the strange, looking for the unfamiliar, recognizing that sometimes science, in this case physics, can't always answer its own problems. The reason why I say that is many of the physicists really enjoyed how we gave them feedback on their own projects, right? I mean, a big part of physics is science communication and the education part that Ingrid was talking about earlier. So it was a slow burn, but I came to realize what we have to offer the physicists, never mind what they have to offer us. And I think that cultural context and how that's fostered and at different moments in history, it's closer and in other times it's further away is just really powerful. It's really powerful to be in the same room with people who speak a different language, mathematics or theoretical physics, but then the ways in which there are rapprochements, I think is really quite like inspiring.
Yeah. Oh, well, I was just going to add one of the major elements of the project was to look at how language changes moving through different disciplines. And so that was such a fascinating part of the whole project. And so when we can talk about, that kind of language of materiality and how we understand that so-called messiness of that reality to the most sophisticated kind of words and vocabulary that's used to describe the phenomena of the universe, to describe the phenomena of reality. And as we work together, I think we as I mean as artists, we def for me also as a teacher, the language that was being used by the physicists started to migrate into my own discussions of works with students. It did open up a new kind of percept way of perceiving reality and even aesthetics, and being able to expand the kind of branches of knowledge just by bringing migrating the language that they're using into the art realm.
Yeah, I want to jump in here too. I tell this story often, and it's one of the pieces of writing in our book. From our initial conversation with Triumph, with the director and deputy director, and then for the duration of our collaboration, many of the physicists kept using the word beauty. And I think I kept turning to Ingrid every so often and just like looking at her, like, why are they talking about it? And so initially I thought they were using the word beauty because they thought that that's what we artists were invested in, which is not necessarily the case. In fact, sometimes beauty is like kind of looked down on, right? And then as these conversations unfolded, I realized it has nothing to do with us. It has everything to do with physics and physics language and the differences in their meanings. We realized that for the physicists, beauty is a core idea in how they try to get at an elegant theory, right? So that theory, the more the tighter the mathematical equation is, the more beautiful it is, the more elegant it is. So they're very interested in symmetry, which they look for in some ways in the universe, but they also look for in how they communicate those ideas. So I'm really thankful for the work with the physicists in thinking about beauty in completely new ways, and then realizing that how can we bring that into contemporary art practice in a way that is meaningful, that is profound, that does speak to this historical moment that we're in.
My next question would be, where did the most productive misunderstandings happen? Language, methods, time frames, or expectations wise?
One of the aspects of the project was to test models of interaction. How can artists and scientists work together in a way where artists are not being a service to science? They're not illustrating the concept, but rather, how do we understand knowledge through different kinds of frameworks? That look very different. How can we speak about these things? And how does it change when we move through those different languages? And so the notion so we told the artists at the beginning each time, we don't want you to illustrate, we want you to respond. But we did these kinds of interactions 3 times in 6 years. Each time we curated 25 artists, a diverse physicist. So overall, over the 6 years, we had like 75 artists and 38 physicists that we had brought together. But each time, it was a different model of interaction. So that we could see, okay, how does this is this a good way to work, or this other way? So whether it's one-on-one team, whether one-on-one partnership, or whether it's teams. For example, when we moved from the first model, which was a one-on-one partnership between artist and physicist, into the next one where we had teams, not just of physicists, but also of other scholars. So it would be like a team of maybe five, six people and a few artists, so that they would, within their own small grouping, so we'd have 10 teams, for example. That was a different way of interacting, because then you have already this kind of bouncing ideas from one person, from one discipline through another, and so on. And so some of the interactions, so for example, some of the one-on-ones, sometimes it was hard for the artist and the scientist to click. Like one of our artists described her experience as it was sort of like being underwater or in outer space in terms of, having that. Being able to communicate because they had such different ways of examining the world. And that kind of that reality also came into the work. So it wasn't something that was kind of covered up. So you just kind of, it's sort of like it is an experimental model when you look at, okay, what happens when these two particle forces come together, and what emerges. And sometimes it's like this amazing flow, and at other times it's full of crackles and crunchy bits sort of thing. But it was really important to allow it just to come up. And in some cases, the scientist, when we always gave the chance for the scientist also to be making responses to what the artist was doing. But I don't know, a miscommunication or different ways of seeing was definitely a big part of it.
And certainly productive as well, I guess, for the artist.
Yes.
Certainly, I don't know for the physicists, but I guess the
Yes, and this whole the sense of trying to grasp something. So one of our artists, Elizabeth Mackenzie, said it was so difficult to understand the premise of antimatter, which was the theme of the first iteration of this. And so she wound up, I mean, she had a really good rapport with her physicist, but at the same time, she was so confused and so puzzled by this idea and the whole formula for antimatter and what does this mean? So she started to make these ink drawings of the formula itself. And she would just let the ink kind of, expand and flow and seep and so on. So she did and like countless iterations of that particular formula. And to be able to grasp in some way through that repetition. And when we brought this work back to the scientists, because we always would go back to the scientists and say, here's the work that emerged from this. And when they saw her work and they said, well, that makes a lot of sense to us, that repetition, that's also what we do over and over and over to get somewhere. So that was, again, a really interesting observation and experience.
Yeah, I guess I'll add one of the things, as Ingrid said earlier, is we bring the artists in for a science seminar on the topic. So we did it on antimatter. Remind me, Ingrid, emergence and then
Emergence
invisible.
and invisible forces.
And it's a lot of information, and in describing Elizabeth Mackenzie's works, the artist's overwhelmed, and but we're not asking them to illustrate it. So what's interesting is what they pull out of all the information they receive that informs an artwork. And sometimes it's just one little thread, one little thing that intrigues them, and it could be a word, and it could be a drawing, because the physicists in their seminars did beautiful presentations and showed us diagrams and drawings, and so there. It's not that it's a miscommunication, but it's the idea of pulling out one thing to sort of expand on in the art. And sometimes it builds on the artist's own practice, because we encourage them not to just suddenly make new work, but to make work in the kind of trajectory of their own practice. And so it was really interesting to see what they drew on of these respective theories. Antimatter could have 5, 10 different things. So when we had our exhibition, it wasn't uniform because everybody took a different aspect of it. Right. And so the other thing I remember when we brought it to the physicists was they were surprised at what the artists were attracted to. And it's not necessarily the thing that they thought was the kind of key aspect, let's say, of antimatter, but it allowed them to see it fresh. And so not so much a miscommunication, but it's just by pulling that out, it sort of, I guess, put a magnifying glass on it. So I was really, really intrigued by that. The other thing I wanted to say was that in terms of miscommunication, there's also assumptions that we had of each other's practices. And we worked with the science communicator at Triumph to bring in physicists that wanted to work on our project. And we didn't realize how many of them wanted to make art. How many of them wanted to be engaged in that? And as Ingrid said, they did their own version, and we actually installed some of their work alongside the artists. So this kind of misunderstanding of each other's practices also led to bringing a kind of surprise to one's own practice. It was just kind of the investment that they brought to it, I think, surprised everybody, artists and physicists included.
We asked one of the well we asked we had a panel discussion after a public panel discussion after the first iteration on antimatter, and one of the physicists, Tim Myers, he talked about going through the exhibit, and that in going through it, he could see in another way how scientists think. looking through the art itself. And because the artists themselves also were, they didn't hold to the purity of some concept. They were looking at it in relation to world politics, materiality, personal issues, philosophy. So it was a much larger way of responding to a concept of antimatter, which is, a very fundamental mystery of atomic of being here, even in the universe. So that sense, when we saw the overall works, it was clear that the artists bring the world into the work. They don't stay with that scientific, whereas the scientists try to take away all the static when they're looking at something to get really into the purity of that phenomena that they're studying. So if you bring it back to this broader knowledge, area of knowledge of art as also producing knowledge, then you bring it in relation to all of these other aspects of our world. So that was something that was interesting for him to say, that he could see, in another way how scientists think by looking through all of that work.
It also reminds me, Ingrid, of when Tim was speaking. So the physicists came to the exhibition after they had worked with the artists. Tim was saying how he went through the exhibition like it was a physics paper, which I thought was kind of charming. So he would go to the label, and I guess maybe like a chapter heading, and then he would pull back and look at the work, and he'd go back to the label again. And so it was interesting the way that he thought about it, like a kind of maybe a linear logical progression of an argument. And that was really beautiful because being comfortable going through a contemporary art exhibition, if it's not your forte, was something that we sort of meant. We did tours as well, but I just really loved the idea that he brought this idea of a physics paper to the reading of an exhibition. And, so there's this kind of exchange and misunderstandings and misapplications, but so productive.
Thank you so much, Ingrid and Randy. Caméra fantôme. Grammaire fantôme. Une émission par Nadia Lichtig.